literally tastes the same, looks the same, and is 100% fat-free and so much more healthy for you. You gotta try that plain, fat-free Greek yogurt as a substitute for your sour cream. Little guac is good in the mix as well. You can season it and add to your taste as you'd like. But the next time you're making a taco salad or a Mexican salad, or maybe even ordering the Cinco de Mayo pizza from your local pizza shop, tell them you want the veggies on the side and keep those ingredients separate until the very second you go to eat it. Everything stays nice and fresh. You can reheat it the next day or two or 3 days later, and it still is awesome. So, Grandma Ruth, I sure hope you don't mind me sharing a little bit of that recipe with everybody. And I hope that you like my new idea on how to serve it so that the chips and everything just stay nice and fresh and crisp anytime you go to eat it. Again, my name is Jacob Patterson. I'm the KBPS radio broadcasting instructor here at Benson Polytechnic High School, sharing a little bit of the Patterson family recipe for Mexican salad, taco salad with you on this episode of Delicious Food and Cooking on the Student Hour. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the Student Hour, amplifying student voices from the city of Portland and beyond. The Student Hour is produced by KBPS broadcasting students at Benson Tech. On air since 1923, KBPS is the voice of the Portland Public Schools. Thanks to our supporters, partners, and listeners like you. Full episodes of the Student Hour are available online at kbps.am.
Hi, I'm Michael Van Cleek. I'm tapped into the vibe and the rhythm of the river of the city of Portland, and you are too, because you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Don't know what to get your loved ones this season? Check out kboo.fm/merch to snag some KBOO swag to support community media in style. While you're shopping for gifts, you can make donations to help support KBOO's $75,000 goal for our KBOO Fights Back campaign, now through December 31st.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from the Bureau of Labor and Industries Child Care for Construction, working to provide resources and support for construction apprentices registered with the state of Oregon, in partnership with Business Oregon. More info at oregon.gov/BOLI/apprenticeship under the link Financial Assistance for Registered Apprentices.
1, 2, 3, 4. Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 0.
Never been done before.
We're talking about a subject.
To bring you to the light.
Farewell to you, people.
JVD, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. And today we want to talk about something that is very relevant when we're talking about housing and we're talking about policing. But I really want to center this around an excellent book. It is called Indefensible Spaces, Policing and the Struggle for Housing. And it focuses on policies that emerge right here in the great state of California in a place called Antelope Valley. And somebody who not only talks about these policies and how we may look at them in today's current climate, but gives us an in-depth history, a history that is often not shared, about the very beginnings of settlement in this region of California and how some of the racial policies started to emerge. So joining us to break this down is the author of the book. His name is Rahim Korwa. He is an assistant professor of criminology, law, and justice, and affiliated faculty in sociology at the University of Illinois in Chicago. Welcome to the show, Rahim. And man, there's a lot to uncover in the book. It's a history book. It's giving you a lot of policies, I think, in today's climate where we see safety nets being removed left and right. Some of the things that are talked about, you can look and say, wow, this is happening, or you anticipate it about to happen. But it's fascinating. So let's start off. What encouraged you to write this book in the first place? And if you can maybe give us a brief synopsis of what it's about, and then we can jump in to some of the particulars.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. Maybe I'll give a brief synopsis first. The book really centers or opens on the story of a woman named Michelle Ross and her family, who moved in 2008 from Los Angeles to Palmdale, one of the main cities in the Antelope Valley, which is about 1 hour north of downtown Los Angeles, or like the Hollywood sign kind of area. The Antelope Valley is like a high desert region on like the kind of peripheral kind of area of Los Angeles County. For listeners in the Bay Area, it sort of functions the same way a place like Antioch might function in relationship to sort of like San Francisco and Oakland. And it's not long after she moves to Palmdale that Michelle Ross starts to experience a series of kind of like harassing and threatening incidents. City inspectors show up and want to inspect her home for compliance because she is a Section 8 Housing Choice Voucher tenant, one of the nation's largest rental assistance programs for low-income families. Her name and her address get put on an I Hate Section 8 Facebook page back in 2008, 2009. And then from there, people graffiti her home. Someone drives by and throws urine, a bottle of urine at her children. She's essentially sort of like forced into hiding or forced to move with a friend, right? These especially repeat inspections by the city, the sheriff's department, sometimes up to 20 sheriff's deputies would show up to sort of rifle through her home for any evidence of something that could be considered a violation of the Section 8 program that could allow them to evict her from her home. And it turns out that Michelle Ross was one of thousands of tenants in the Antelope Valley who were experiencing this type of policing. And the question really is like, how did this happen, right? And why, right? And I think that's where sort of three really important threads come together. Number one is, what is the Antelope Valley today? And I think it sort of functions like a sort of safety valve for Los Angeles. You know, back in the aftermath of World War II, for example, the Antelope Valley became one of the main sort of manufacturing hubs for the aerospace industry, right? As that kind of industry couldn't really all be contained in just Los Angeles alone, right? And so the Antelope Valley absorbs some of that, right? And then in the wake of the sort of end of the Cold War, when that economy evaporates, the Antelope Valley becomes a place with a lot of cheap housing, and then it ends up absorbing people who are getting pushed out of Los Angeles, right? And so it's always played that role. And I think it's similar to a place like Antioch in the Bay Area in terms of absorbing people who are getting pushed out of the major cities. Secondly, it's also a story of housing policy, right? And as we move from public housing to programs like vouchers, those programs are pushing people out into suburban areas or dispersing them. And then thirdly, you have this history of policing, the role that policing plays in kind of promoting or protecting racial segregation, and the role of policing in being a sort of invasive instrument to kind of surveil and regulate people's homes. And that especially has happened to Black tenants, both in public housing and in the voucher program. And all three of these things come together in the story of Michelle Ross and the tenants in the Antelope Valley in the Section 8 program.
You know, Rahim, when you mentioned Section 8 and you say the name Michelle Ross, immediately I think what goes to a lot of people's minds, unfortunately, Section 8, she's probably trouble anyway. You know, what did she do? People just came after her. Probably housing gangbangers or something like that. There's all these stereotypes that at this point are so embedded in our understanding in our perception of people who are on Section 8, that folks literally will say probably deserves it, and they will wag their finger and say, this is why I don't want Section 8 in my house, in my neighborhood. We've all heard the horror stories that people have, you know, amplified. You know, we had a tenant who came in, he was on Section 8, and he destroyed the place. Forget about the fact that this happens with apartments and rent, you know, people who rent out homes, no matter what, all over the place. It can be very rich, can be very poor. But the stereotype is going to go to somebody like Michelle. So that's point one. The other point, which I think is really important, this is where I want to start off, is history and context. And you start off the book by talking about the exploitation of indigenous folks. You know, guy that settles into Antelope Valley and literally steals their artifacts and opens up a museum. And I thought that was pretty important because it kind of underscores the dehumanization that a majority culture often has towards indigenous folks and those who are classified as minority. And, you know, let's tell the story about this museum. And then into Charles Graves. And I think that kind of sets the tone of what we're dealing with.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so let me just say that I got involved in this research because I began to accompany a lawyer who was challenging the treatment of Michelle Ross and many other tenants. And from there, it became obvious that, like, there was a much bigger story to be told. And over time, you know, I interviewed local residents and they expressed many of the attitudes you just, you know, he sort of reported on about the sort of anti-Section 8 sentiment, right? And one day I sat down and listed out all of the ways, all the problems that people had with Section 8 tenants, right? And I realized that there's no way you can be a Section 8 tenant in the Antelope Valley that works in their eyes, right? If you didn't have a car, it was a sign that you weren't working. If you did have a car, but the car was too nice, it was a sign that you were cheating the system. If you did have a car, but the car wasn't nice enough, you know, you were dragging down the look of the place, right? So, like, in all these ways, there was never going to be a correct way to be a tenant in Section 8 in the Antelope Valley, right? But to go back even further, right, the Antelope Valley has this long history, actually, as a place of Native living and also especially sort of Native commerce and travel. And relatively early on in the 1940s and 50s, as it begins to sort of be more formally sort of colonized, there's an effort to sort of create this museum of Native history there. And the man at the center of building this museum does so in a very kind of like orientalist or like make it up as you go kind of way, where he imposes his own stories about Native peoples in how he organizes and presents these artifacts, right? And kind of makes them out to seem sort of like fantastical. And, you know, he's like playing house in a way, right? And I think, and that place still stands today. It's still an ongoing existing museum today. And the important thing about it is that the function of creating that museum was to sort of say that there wasn't really anyone here who we have to respect or take seriously before we came. And that when we decided to sort of make this a white suburb of LA, that's like sort of the starting point for the Antelope Valley's history. And in reality, it's really not the case, right? And actually, not only was there a longstanding sort of indigenous presence there, but also there are amazing and important histories of Black residency and placemaking in the Antelope Valley that go back to the late 1800s, right? And you mentioned Charles Graves, one of the most important sort of figures in that history. After the Civil War, he takes the Southern Pacific Railroad and gets off in Rosamond, which is like Northern Antelope Valley, and starts a career in mining. And he gets pretty wealthy because he strikes gold in the mines there. And he uses his wealth to start the first racially integrated public school in the Antelope Valley, serves as the first postmaster for the Antelope Valley, and serves as an election administrator, right, until the early 1900s when he passes away, right? But that kind of a history is incompatible with the history of the Antelope Valley that says this has always been a white place, and that anything that changes or challenges that is sort of illegitimate, right? And that's always been the way that the Antelope Valley of today has responded to Black residents moving up from LA, poor people moving up from LA, you know, Latinx people moving up. It's always been responded to as, no, this is a white place and anything else is illegitimate. And that story requires you to sort of forget or never know that people like Charles Graves or many of these other communities had ever existed there.
I think it's important to note the insistence, you know, of whiteness in a place like Antelope Valley. It is a stark reality to the understanding we have of California being this great blue bastion of progressivism and, you know, and racial harmony and multiculturalism and all this stuff. And what I'm getting from that is a couple of things. One, there is this very contentious and very deadly racial history that existed here. There are these sharp contradictions, first starting with indigenous folks being here and people thinking like when we moved out west, we were there to take over something that had yet to be discovered. No, you moved out and slaughtered a bunch of people. And then the history of Black folks here, and I bring this up because there's a trend that is on social media these days, and it's almost like a campaign where you have people who just recently arrived, you know, from back east or somewhere, and they're doing videos talking about there's no Black people in California. You know, it's like 3 million people live here. Obviously, out of the 40, it's not going to seem a lot, but it also underrides this history of, like, not all Black people live in Oakland and Los Angeles. And there are these towns, you know, throughout the valley where we have been there, the Allendales and the Sun Villages, which comes back to the initial point about where Black people could actually live in California, which was not a slave state, but, you know, had these policies of discrimination. So let's talk a little bit about this, because in this case, you know, the other underlying thing is resistance. People just didn't take this on the chin. And I think the story of Charles Graves is important because it talks about, you know, how people were resisting outright discrimination that was backed up by, you know, the highest offices of the land.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what you bring up there about places like Allensworth and Sun Village is really important because, so for context, Sun Village becomes the sort of all-Black town in the Antelope Valley because Black residents who are moving up from LA are shut out of Palmdale and Lancaster. Palmdale was one of the early sundown towns. I think the majority of people who were moving to Sun Village or moving to the Antelope Valley who were Black residents were moving from LA, but it's not completely exclusive. Some people were moving from, you know, sort of from the East Coast or from the South. And in fact, like, the most important person in the story of Sun Village actually comes from Chicago, a man named Melvin Ray Grubbs, right? And
right.
He lives through the Depression in Chicago, comes to Los Angeles, and comes with a sort of independent streak. His feeling is that if we appeal to white Antelope Valley residents for integration, we're never going to get it. We have to build our own community and sort of stand up on our own. And so by the sort of mid-1930s, he had purchased and established sort of the land deeds for this town, Sun Village. And starting in the early 1930s, but especially accelerating in the 40s and 50s, you begin to see lots of Black families move up to the Antelope Valley into Sun Village and buy those parcels. So that even by the 1940s, you had ads for Sun Village showing up in the major Black papers in Los Angeles. And by the 50s, it had churches, it had, you know, associations, and by the early 60s, it had an NAACP chapter, right? It became a very thriving, functioning, self-sustaining community by then.
And what happened to Sun Village? What's the trajectory?
That's a really interesting story, or interesting question, because it's had some real ups and downs in a way. So in some ways, Sun Village is really like a product of forces in LA itself, right? Because if you think back to 1920s and 1930s Los Angeles, Black residents are really caught between two types of exploitation, right? Living in Los Angeles, there would be the restrictive covenants that were placed on homes that said, this home cannot be rented or sold to a non-white person. So Black residents couldn't purchase or buy homes throughout much of LA, right? And we're kind of being concentrated into just sort of like the South Central corridor. And on the other hand, within that region, they were also being exploited through, you know, really high housing prices for substandard housing, and then being exploited in the labor market and so on, right? And this kind of creates like a pressure valve where, in order to not just like live, but to really thrive, you've got to get out of LA itself, right? And so people go to, you know, for a minute, people go to Bruce's Beach or to Valley Verde or like Allensworth or Sun Village and many other of these peripheral kind of places around Los Angeles. And it really begins to thrive in the 40s, 50s, and 60s as the community grows really substantially. But they're also working on civil rights and fair housing organizing out there in Sun Village. And it's sort of ironic in a way that like the success of that fair housing organizing actually kind of undermines Sun Village in a way, because after 1968, when the Fair Housing Act passes, Black residents don't just have to live in Sun Village and begin to live all over the Antelope Valley, you know, maybe to be closer to work or closer to some schools or other amenities or what have you, right? And that kind of weakens Sun Village's residential base. And in the sort of 70s, 80s, 90s, Sun Village is kind of on a decline a little bit. But today, actually, the community institutions that had been built back then in the 50s and 60s, things like the Jackie Robinson Park, the first park in the nation named in honor of Robinson, many of its really important churches and other community institutions, those have still persisted up to today. And today, I think there's a sort of reinvigoration or rediscovery of Sun Village in a way where there's sort of a return to Sun Village amongst many people who are kind of rebuilding and revitalizing it in many ways. So it's had these ups and downs over sort of the history of Los Angeles.
Rahim is our guest, the author of the book, Indefensible Spaces. You mentioned a couple of things. You mentioned Bruce's Beach among one. And one of the challenges that we've had, and you kind of talk a little bit about this, is the forced taking over of spaces. You know, you mentioned these institutions that show up and their covenants, there's unwritten, you know, rules, written rules, all this. And next thing you know, people don't have their land anymore, right? And, you know, when you mentioned Bruce's Beach, I just remember that long fight, you know, for families to have land returned. You know, I don't know how long that fight went and if all the land has fully been returned, but that's just one. And, you know, eminent domain, that's the word I was looking for, and all these other things. How has that played a role in the shaping of Antelope Valley and in particular with Black residents, you know, in and around Los Angeles? And I'll just conclude with this, because, you know, one of the things we often talk about is the formation of hip hop. And one of the things with that history are this whole concept of urban renewal, freeways being built in the middle of Black neighborhoods and completely erase their history. And folks will drive over a freeway and not realize it was home to Black folks or, you know, other folks who had no choice but to be, you know, literally run over.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let me say this about Bruce's Beach. Bruce's Beach and Sun Village are actually very tied together in a way, right? Way back in the early 1900s, the chaplain of the Buffalo Soldiers, a man named Captain George Prelo, he quits the Buffalo Soldiers after the Spanish-American War. His experience serving in the U.S. Army alongside the Buffalo Soldiers, which is like the first all-Black infantry, he witnesses the extraordinary amount of racism that the Buffalo Soldiers encounter in the American South. And he feels it's so hypocritical to sort of fight foreign wars on behalf of the United States for liberty when you're not really free at home. And so he and his family retire and they move to Bruce's Beach in the early 1920s. And, you know, they're thriving there for years. They establish a really important church in Los Angeles. I mean, they're doing all kinds of things, right? But they're one of the families that gets swept up in this eminent domain case where the city of Manhattan Beach, the KKK, the local real estate, you know, sort of lobby, the neighbors, et cetera, all conspire to sort of seize and wipe away the Bruce's Beach development, which is like a number of homes, you know, on this beautiful beach area. And it turns out that like the youngest child of the Priolo family, Lois Priolo, ends up becoming the main organizer of the Sun Village NAACP, right? Her family ends up moving to Sun Village in the 50s and 60s, and they begin that civil rights organizing there. And so you actually see this continuity across generations of displacement and struggle and resistance, mm-hmm. right? Just even in this one family's sort of life history, right? But I think it is, you know, it does show that like these patterns sort of repeat themselves in many ways, because the Priolo family was never, I think, properly recognized, or there were never really proper reparations for what happened to them at Bruce's Beach. The story of that really centers around the Bruce family, you know, more so than the other families that were there. And then when you get to the story of Sun Village, right, it's a story of, you know, the ongoing sort of like policing of housing in the Antelope Valley, the ways that people end up getting sort of evicted illegally or sort of unconstitutionally, and the struggle to sort of fairly repair that damage that had been done, you know, in a new generation as well.
Because of the racial discrimination, do you connect the forming of Altadena, you know, with Sun Village and those areas? Because Altadena in many ways becomes a black enclave, specifically because LA wasn't allowing, you know, folks outside the Central District to move. You know, the policy that we always like to say, it was a policy of containment. Like, mm-hmm. y'all can stay right here and nowhere else, right? Yeah. And so people found these other places, Sun Village being one, Altadena being the other. And I don't know if they overlap in years in which they form, if there's a kind of a back and forth between the two places in terms of these being safe havens and spots where people can build. And I say that because of the Jackie Robinson, you know, significance and, you know, definitely in Altadena. And then you're talking about the park being named in Sun Village.
Yeah. I don't know. I can't say for sure how closely Altadena and Sun Village might have been linked, but I do think that Sun Village is linked to a number of other places in Los Angeles. You know, number one that comes to mind would be sort of like Fontana. Reason being that like both the Antelope Valley and places like kind of Fontana, Riverside, were places where that kind of military industrial production gets moved, you know, in the 40s and 50s. And that brings a lot of black workers, you know, to kind of pulled in those directions. But in terms of like a group of places that black residents are kind of squeezed into because you can't just survive this containment within a narrow section of Los Angeles, I think in that sense, yeah, Altadena and Sun Village definitely share that in common. And if I could just say something about the Jackie Robinson Park, I mean, it's a really interesting history. So the story is essentially that the local organizers in Sun Village, the Sun Village Women's Club, Sun Village NAACP, I mean, one of the key things that they're finding as parents is that their children are not allowed to play in the public parks of the Antelope Valley, like in Palmdale. And so they realize, like, we need to build our own park, right? Mm-hmm. And they work with the county government they purchased the land themselves and they sell it to the county government with the promise that the county government will turn it into a park. And they want to name it in honor of Robinson at the time. And I think it's really remarkable because this is still at a time when, you know, Pasadena, his hometown, right, wants nothing to do with him, right? And he grew up in his memoirs talking about the experience of the fact that like the parks and playgrounds and swimming pools in his own neighborhoods were segregated and closed off. Like Pasadena has one of the strongest histories of segregated, you know, swimming pools and so on, right?
Right.
And so Robinson comes out for the dedication and the groundbreaking multiple times to visit the park. And, you know, I think it was very important to him to establish that park. And this happens before, you know, the Jackie Robinson Park in New York City, before any of the other major kind of recognitions of him through these types of parks and other public memorials. And that park has remained a really important community institution all the way to this day.
Raheem, in the book, you really lay out a fascinating view of, you know, public housing, the demolition of public housing, and the arrival of vouchers. And within that, and this is a story I think that's universal for a lot of people, especially if they grew up at particular points in time, the policing of families, you know, it's something that people kind of joke about or they say in passing, but I don't think they really reflect on what that means. And I think you lay it out in a way that's like, you know, when we talk about the agonizing decisions that many Black families had to deal with if you wanted to have housing, keeping in mind that it oftentimes wasn't a case of you not being able to afford it as much as it was that you weren't allowed anywhere else. So your inability to afford a $200,000 house when you only made $50,000 meant that you had to make, you know, live in public housing. I'm just using that as an example. And then the agonizing decision of, well, if you stay in public housing, the government is your daddy. Talk a little bit about that, because this kind of underscores this attitude in you know, sense of entitlement. Like, of course we're going to police and regulate your home.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, stepping back, I think we tend to think of like policing as a problem over here and housing as a problem over here, and not so much think about the ways that policing and housing overlap, right? And the intersections of those two major problems, right? But it's always been the case, right? If you go back to thinking about the history of slavery, right? The surveillance and policing of Black homes during that era was really important to how slavery was maintained, right? And even in the early, you know, Reconstruction years, the right to home, the right to shelter was a very important part of the discussions of why we needed the 14th Amendment and the other Reconstruction amendments, right? And even in Jim Crow, for example, right, in the early 1900s, you see scholars like Kidada Williams writing about the Knight Riders who targeted Black homes in the South, right, as a mechanism of upholding white supremacy is to attack the home itself, right? And that wasn't just happening in the South. It was happening in the North as well, right? The jump raids in the tenement homes in New York in the 1910s, right? Again, like really just target the home and regulate people in their homes. They force people to kind of break up their families, put a child in to stay with someone else, et cetera, to keep everybody safe from these kinds of raids, whether they're by sort of like vigilantes or by agents of the government, right? Police or other, you know, city officials, right? And then when we see the sort of era of public housing, you see those same practices show up again, right? In the 1950s and 60s, states had the ability to essentially like regulate or verify who was in the home. They had these sort of what were called man in the house rules that said that tenants in public housing had to be single mothers, right? That was the scheme for how welfare was provided, was that, you know, welfare was given as a substitute for the father of the nuclear family, in a sense, right? So if there was going to be a father in the home or a man in the house, you wouldn't really be eligible for welfare, right? Well, the only way to like verify that is to surveil people's homes. And the man in the house rules were combined with these things called the midnight raids, where welfare inspectors would show up to people's public housing units in the middle of the night looking to see if they could catch a man there, right? Or even if there wasn't a person there, if they could find men's shoes or like a coat or something like that. That was
a shaving kit.
Exactly, right.
All like those things,
That would be enough to kick the family out of welfare, right? And it even led families to proactively have to break up just to be able to get housing for at least the mother and children, right? And that's exactly what you see play out in the Antelope Valley in the 2010s, in an era where California is supposed to be this progressive, multiracial, et cetera, kind of a place, right? Section 8 tenants living in the Antelope Valley all of a sudden find themselves heavily surveilled, not just by the city government that's trying to get rid of them, but also by their neighbors who are trying to get rid of them as well. And there's such a large toolbox of ways that you could evict your neighbor if they're on Section 8, that these residents had all kinds of ways to get rid of them, right? You could make a nuisance housing complaint. You could use a crime-free housing ordinance. You could accuse them of violating the Section 8, housing rules themselves. All of these things work.
These are just private citizens.
Exactly.
Who, the birth of Ken and Karens.
Exactly. Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah, and they're essentially sort of self-deputizing, into this role of policing, where they can pick up the phone and make one of these complaints and initiate investigations or a police raid on the home, et cetera. And several tenants in the voucher program told me when I interviewed them that many times what they were going through was very similar to the original man in the house rules, right? That if you had, a boyfriend or a girlfriend come visit you and someone complained, you could be accused of having an unauthorized tenant living there, right? We have these very strict one-strike eviction rules around crime-free housing ordinances where, if your child had like a juvenile incident on their record, you would either have to evict your child and find them somewhere else to live, or the whole family would have to vacate, the home. There were even cases where tenants were accused of harboring unauthorized tenants because something like a male-presenting coat was spotted there, and it was just the fashion or dress choice of the resident themselves, right? But like that was the level of surveillance that neighbors were getting into in order to try to come up with reasons to evict Section 8 tenants, right? But it shows this long continuity of how important policing the home is to maintaining this system of sort of anti-blackness.
You're talking about a practice that's going on here in California in 2010, this overt policing, by self-deputized neighbors, calling the cops on folks for literally just living. But part of this thing with the vouchers, we can get into a whole conversation because you talk about how vouchers were used to maintain segregation and then they become a tool to maybe, desegregate. And so I call it voucher wars after reading your book. Mm-hmm. But with that being said, the whole thing of vouchers kind of, skips over the fact that all this public housing was destroyed, from Chicago where, you're at, and all the way, to, we saw this after Katrina, LA, San Francisco, all these places where people actually did have a community, for better or for worse, gets destroyed. And they're like, here's a voucher. So having a voucher is, I think on the surface, it seems like freedom. Like you can go live wherever you want. You don't have to be caught up in, the Pink Palace or, Cabrini Green or whatever the name of the projects are. But from what you're writing, it's actually more of a prison and you're very much isolated than if you were just living in public housing. Can we talk a little bit about that? Because that's why these folks are doing Section 8.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a critical part of the story, right? Is that the nation begins to stop investing in the repair, maintenance, construction of public housing, as soon as it becomes open to Black families, as soon as it undergoes integration and, as early as the 40s, 50s, 60s, right? And really, unfortunately, I think the Democratic Party and the Republican Party found an area of agreement to demolish public housing. The Republican Party was just against public housing and the New Deal entirely. But the Democratic Party, I think, in its most neoliberal era, really saw a window to move away from public housing through the idea of the voucher as, like you said, freedom, right? That the voucher was going to be the fulfillment of the fair housing law, right? Because theoretically, you could take your voucher and move anywhere. Therefore, you could overcome racial segregation. And the reality is that the voucher actually puts you at the bottom of the housing market, because no matter what the law actually says, landlords can very easily discriminate against voucher tenants and you know, deny them those leases. And so in reality, when you look at across the country, the map of where voucher tenants are able to actually end up moving to, it looks like the weakest parts of the housing market in any region, which is not what fair housing, you know, which is not by any means an actual map of what fair housing would be, right? Most of the voucher tenants I talked to in the Antelope Valley didn't particularly want to live in the Antelope Valley. It was just the place where they could find housing, someone willing to rent to them, right? And LA is a sort of extreme case of that, because during the Red Scare was very successful in stopping the construction of most of LA's public housing. There's not that many public housing developments compared to in New York or Chicago. And so it always was kind of leaning more towards vouchers. It was always going to be in that kind of a situation. But here in Chicago, you know, as we demolished roughly 50,000 people worth of public housing over the last 20, 30 years, I mean, no surprise we're in a housing crisis, right? We replaced some of that with vouchers, and tenants with those vouchers have been pushed out of Chicago or into the margins of Chicago, or, you know, to port those vouchers into the Chicago suburbs. And that's only increased people's sort of marginalization over time, right? So although this program has this promise of freedom, the reality is much different, as you pointed out.
In the case of Michelle Ross, the center of the book, the type of harassment that she was dealing with, it's boggling, because here's somebody who, for the most part, wasn't a criminal in any sort of sense, didn't fit any of the quote-unquote stereotypes, and was somebody just going about their business in trying to, you know, live life, and didn't want anybody to know that you were in Section 8. So the outing of that is problematic, and maybe we could talk a little bit about that. But also, it comes at a time, because of the gentrification in LA, you talk about the population goes from 5% Black to 15% Black in Antelope Valley in a short period of time. So there's a large influx of folks, kind of like Oakland to Antioch or San Francisco to Antioch, you know, where you have similar type of resistance, you know, in the form of the police in Antioch, you know, in those outlying places, residents who want to maintain a sort of, you know, dominant presence and all that sort of stuff. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, that situation with Michelle Ross, because that's, you know, that's a sustained campaign. And I'll conclude with this. Nowadays, what I see from LA to Stockton to here, the proliferation of these websites that now purport just to report on crime, and they show the very, I call it doom looping, you know, and it's become very popular. People get money for it, but they also serve a purpose, which would lead to more folks experiencing what a Michelle does, you know, like, let's target this individual, let's highlight them, and let's demonize them, or an entire community, which then ultimately results, you know, first in recalls, or in policy changes that bash on, you know, large swaths of a population.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is like, we got an early glimpse of that in the story of the Section 8 tenants at the Antelope Valley, right? The reason that Michelle Ross got graffitied, you know, her home got graffitied and the urine thrown at her kids and all this, was because her name and address was put on a Facebook page called I Hate Section 8, right? And that was just like a version 1.0 of Nextdoor, Ring, Citizen, you know, whose original name was Vigilante, right, as an app. Mm-hmm. I mean, these practices of citizen involvement in this like sort of like omnipresent surveillance and constant policing of their neighborhoods has now become big business, right? And I think that there's a lot to unpack as to what's going on there, right? You talk about this kind of doom looping as a practice that makes money, you know, and all of that, even in a place like the Antelope Valley, where that practice, you know, there wasn't necessarily someone making money directly from it, you know, but it was still valuable to people in the Antelope Valley, you know.
Well, the fact that you had police involved in all the step away makes money for them, or at least keeps it off as job security.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And I think the people who participated on these forums and websites and things, number one, I think they thought that they were preserving the kind of economic future of the Antelope Valley, because they saw that as being, we can survive as long as we're a white suburb, you know, because people will still want to move here if we're a white suburb. But the minute we're seen as diverse, or that there are, you know, non-wealthy people here or something like that, then we're doomed. So they, I think they, you know, Mike Davis said it was like raising the gangplanks, right? They wanted to keep people away from coming to the Antelope Valley who weren't gonna fit that mold of the white middle class picket fence kind of thing, right? But also, I mean, I think people got enjoyment, dare I say pleasure, from surveilling and policing their neighbors. You know, some of these local residents I talked to really, like, that became their hobby. You know, like, it was more than just maintaining safety. It, something else had grown out of it in a way, right? And I find that to be some of the most disturbing element of what happened, because I think you see that happening all around the country, right? You know, the sort of Karen, you know, dynamic, right? This doom looping, et cetera. And I think it's really changing the nature of citizenship in this country, or personhood in this country, right? Who gets to do that? And for whom can that only be done to, right? Like, whose home is subject to this kind of intense surveillance and policing all the time? What is that? Is that even a home if it's subject to that level of surveillance and policing? And what kind of homes are places from which you do that kind of policing, where you are using your home as like sort of like a base from which you surveil your neighborhood and report on suspicious people and summon the police, et cetera, right? Like, well, this gradient is being stretched here in a really important way.
Well, reading the book, what's remarkable is the response from police, which lays a blueprint, you know, whether it works in reality for other folks. But it's like, you know, I get up in the morning and go, hey, police, you know, I think Mr. Kura, you know, I think he's selling drugs. You know, what gives you that idea? Well, I saw some wrapping papers near his house. Mm-hmm. And we never had wrapping papers near our house in the 20 years I've been here. And all of a sudden, you know, they look and say, Section 8, near at your house. Searching. Yeah. That's a form of control. And if part of what you have now is the swatting thing, you know, where you call up and that was people having fun doing it to the Kim Kardashians of the world. Let's swat their house. Or later on, you started to see activists, you know, especially in L.A., like Malina Abdullah is one that comes to mind. I had a house like swatted two or three times, which puts you in danger. So being able to drop a dime and get police response is, it's like a macabre type of game that people play.
Yeah. And I think it changes who you are, in a sense. You know, you become a sort of super citizen compared to someone else, right? But it's also important to point out the role of the formal police in this as well, right? The journalist Cerise Castle did a really important expose of LA Sheriff's Department deputy gangs. And the Antelope Valley is one of the places where many of those deputy gangs were stationed. And the level of leeway.
We're talking about the Vikings and 3,000 Boys, all those good.
Yeah, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And the level of kind of like leeway that they had to kind of do whatever they wanted to residents of the Antelope Valley, right? Especially Black and Latinx residents in the Antelope Valley, was unbelievable, right? And that is documented in DOJ, civil rights reports, and so on, that they just terrorized the community for generations, really. until it all kind of boiled over in this Section 8 case, right? Because eventually what was happening to tenants comes to the awareness of local activists, of a group called the Community Action League, of local lawyers, and they start to fight back. I mean, not just with like protests and things like this, but organizing town halls where people give, you know, hundreds of people come to give their testimony about what happened to them, right? And that becomes the basis for litigation. And the nation's first Department of Justice Civil Rights Division case that asserts that policing is violating the Fair Housing Act, right? And even though the case doesn't go to court, it does result in a settlement that dismantles many of the worst of these kind of like policing practices, you know, this ability to sort of drop a dime on someone and so on, right? And so I think you end up seeing like a very kind of like mixed picture of a lot of success of like stopping the direct policing of these Section 8 tenants, but in many ways, a lot of limits because the settlement terms were never fully implemented, you know, between Sheriff Villanueva, the Trump administration, et cetera. The DOJ just doesn't really enforce it, you know, ultimately, right? And right. So you still have a situation where in the Antelope Valley, the policing of Black tenants especially is really, you know, pretty rampant and unchecked. And I think it opens some questions as to where to go next.
We can go on and on to talk about your book, Indefensible Spaces. Our guests have been Rahim Kora. Am I pronouncing your name correctly? Kora.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I guess, you know, you mentioned Trump, the DOJ, and I'm thinking of ICE and Border Patrol and the type of vigilanteism that's embedded in that, you know, not. Where do you see things now with those safety nets removed and this type of, you know, hypervigilance where people are encouraged? Like, call up, I think Rahim is, maybe he's here, you know, illegally. So that's a whole other thing where you literally have cops busting down doors to check and see if you have your papers all correct. Yeah. So it's kind of like we're not only back at square one, but now it's federalized. So even if you have laws on the book and locally, you know, you don't have them on the book federally.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's definitely true, that like this ability for everyday people to feel like they have the power of police at their hands, or that they own this role of policing, right? And to kind of like the fact that it's become casual, you know, to sort of threaten people with either the police or eviction or ICE or, you know, what have you, I think illustrates that this trend is growing, right? That like this engagement with policing, you know, this taking the power of policing into our own hands has really spread dramatically. And I think that we're confronting it not just in the housing space, but also, like you say, in the immigration space, right? In the Antelope Valley today, even though the struggle over the voucher situation has kind of calmed down, it's really moved in a way to schools and the really aggressive policing of schools by the LA County Sheriff's Department. And there's an organization called Cancel the Contract that's really trying to fight back on that heavy, heavy school policing, right? But again, like you said, like around the country, so like those crime-free housing ordinances and nuisance ordinances that were part of the toolkit for policing your neighbors, I mean, they exist in all 50 states. Like they're everywhere around the country.
Right.
And so part of it is like to get rid of those things, get them off the books in cities around the country, or to kind of litigate against them and to really see like how can we dismantle the policing of housing, right? In all the different ways that it happens, right? And once you start looking for those, I think you see a lot of a really big agenda of what we can do to kind of make home a place that's not so heavily policed.
Right. Well, the Dune Looping websites make that a challenge right now, you know, but let me ask you this, and I know we got to go, but if the police are heavily surveilling students at school, then the quote unquote bad behavior, you know, your son threw a rock at a bus, your son had a fight in the bathroom, does that then translate to evictionable, you know, offenses? Like you have a... So I can't get you one way, I'll get you through your kids.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, back in the 2010s, one of the ways they were trying to evict Section 8 families was if children were truant from school or had other kind of like incidents, like you said, in, you know, in schools, they would try to make, you know, sort of like the sins of the child weigh on the whole family, right? And like evict the whole family based on what a kid might have done, right? And that they were successful in fighting back against that through the voucher program. But it's not to say people don't try it, you know, or cities don't try it as one of the many mechanisms to try to erase or evict or expel voucher tenants all around the country.
Yeah, because what immediately comes to mind is just knowing in LA and other places, just to mass identify everybody as a gang member. You live on 18th Street, you must be an 18th Street gang member. You got brown skin, you have to be. You know, even if you're not, you by the time you figure it out, you know, and fight it, if you even knew you were on the gang database, you know, might be too late, but you start to put people in that category. That open, you know, as I always said, it always opened you up for something else. They pull you over and it's like, oh, this is a gang member. You know, it's a different playbook that is applied to you. And and that's a very sinister, you know, legacy of LA and Southern Cal, you know, of being put into those categories without your knowledge.
Yeah. Well, and it almost feels like it's one playbook, you know, just done over and over again, right? Because before they went after voucher tenants, they had the war on gangs, right?
Yeah.
And then they declared victory on the war on gangs in the Antelope Valley and then turned to voucher tenants and just did the same thing over again, right? And now that the voucher thing is sort of off the main page, it's switched to schools, you know? And so but it's the same playbook every time in that sense.
Raheem Kurat, thank you so much for joining us. Indefensible Spaces, Policing, in the Struggle for Housing is the book. We look forward to talking to you some more. Ralph and out. Peace.
Hard Knock Radio. We're rocking with Picasso.
What?
And Maya.
Who?
My last name is Susana.
We all listen. We're in the Fireside Theater. We all listen to this fabulous station in Portland, and it's called K-Boo.
It's a Lorenzo Milam original. It's one of his spawn. And we'd like to say hello to all the people at K-Boo, and then thanks for that coffee cake that that volunteer made 2 days ago.
Yeah, I'm still coming down, man.
This is Bird Note. It's a warm morning in the tropical rainforest. You grab your binoculars and scan the thick canopy. But you're not spotting any birds. Just lots of green leaves and a tree stump. Hold up. That tree stump isn't a tree stump at all. It's a bird. Common pottoos are champions of camouflage. In the daytime, these nocturnal creatures perched perfectly still on branches, heads pointed upward, bodies outstretched, and eyes closed down to tiny slits. With their cryptic coloration of brown, splashes of gray, and black spots, it's hard to tell where the branch ends and the bird's body begins. It's a wondrous adaptation to avoid predators. They're birds more often heard than seen, with a melodious but mournful song made at dawn, dusk, and by the light of the moon. The song earned pottoos the name Poor Me One in Trinidad and Tobago. At dusk, common pottoos awaken and take flight. They use their large yellow-orange eyes, long wings, and wide mouth to sally from a perch and gulp down flying insects. At the end of the night shift, pottoos return to their branches to hide in plain sight for another day. For Bird Note, I'm Joanne Ryan. Thank you.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Dr. Zom's Stereo Obscura. Offbeat sounds for talented listeners. Broadcasts every other Wednesday at 10 p.m.